Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Before I start this show, I believe that I left Vietnam alive 43 years ago. And I went to Japan. I got to Japan on an extension overseas on Valentine's Day in 1967, intending to go back to Vietnam as a civilian correspondent and blow open everything, as every journalist seems to believe he's going to do, or she believes she's going to do. But the Marine Corps decided that I was not going to do anything in their best interest if I was allowed to go back as a civilian, so they denied my accreditation and sent me back stateside. And that moment's remembrance is actually prompted by the fact that today is the 20th anniversary that Nelson Mandela was released from prison in South Africa. He was in prison for 27 years and became South Africa's first black president in 1994, and to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. He is 91. And I'd like to read something I wrote a number of years ago about South Africa. Apartheid means slavery. And I'd like to give my disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, on the entire planet, the entire solar system, the entire cosmos, and however many universes in general. Apartheid means slavery. Begin with a couple of quotes, one by the Progressive in 1985. The South African government is an insult to humanity and deserves the contempt of all civilized beings. And from Martin Luther King Jr., we must all live together as brothers or perish together as fools. And I'd like to read this article in memory of all who died for South Africa's liberation, and especially Stephen Biko, who probably next to Mandela is the most other famous South African liberation fighter. He, of course, was killed by South African police. The irresistible press of history extinguished the apartheid government of white South Africa, which spent most of the 20th century resisting it with the system of slavery that, with brief but periodic exceptions, became repulsive to civilization in the 19th century. White South Africa had imposed itself too long on the world and on its captive people, and finally history finished it off, although the trauma apartheid inflicted will persist for quite some time. White South Africa was itself an anachronism, a lost colony left behind and isolated by the crumbling empires of Europe. It was a final vestige of a colonial system that began five centuries ago, when Europe started its surge across the planet. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for European colonies in the Western Hemisphere, and most of Africa itself was colonized by European nations. For centuries, Africans who were not sent across the ocean as slaves were enslaved at home. The two great wars of the 20th century devastated European power and broke up its empires into independent states, most of which reverted to some form of home rule. The African colonies collapsed in the same manner until, almost alone on the continent and in the world, the white-dominated government of South Africa remained. From the start, the draconian concept of apartheid, which means separation, was white South Africa's defense against cultural extinction, a final entrenchment by an embattled political system struggling to survive a while longer. The entire brutal state apparatus that was designed to deny any political identity or power to the black majority, 70% of the population, could only be a stall against the inevitable tide of their disquiet, and served as a final laceration that ensured their rise to crush it. The systematic arrests and murders of emerging black leaders spawned the appearance of others, the detention, torture, and killing of children to stifle newer generations of insurgents only guaranteed their growth. Each step to maintain the regime was a greater atrocity that created a proportionate response. By the time reforms were offered to appease revolt, they were long past the needs or desires of those in revolt, and most of the time too late to stop them. Once the insurgents' power was recognized by acts of reform, they were too powerful to resist. All of the terrible, crippling pain, fear, and hatred that had been stifled and stored up for so long seemed perpetually prone to explode into rage, and the death dance between oppressor and oppressed speeded up, ruthlessness and reaction evolving inexorably toward denouement. Survival was the major object of apartheid, and the question why white South Africa would want to survive was as irrelevant as why any organism should wish to endure. White South Africa could not afford to compromise, or its visceral history would be lost. Its white culture, however much it repulsed most of the rest of the world, deceived itself that it was vital and historically legitimate. That its memory would undoubtedly be a legacy of intolerance and contempt was not necessarily apparent to itself. Nations, like persons, are not greatly noted for honest self-appraisal. The real fear was that after white rule was dismantled, genocide would be enacted against whites. There also was apprehension that the antipathy that had developed between the black factions and between them, and blacks who worked for whites, might erupt into a civil war or an immense pogrom. A native tyranny as harsh and ruthless as white rule was a great anxiety as well. History was a disquieting precedent. Slow, painful evolution toward political freedom was the hope. But the tendency of regimes released from foreign domination has usually been in the opposite direction. The people of Africa have not fared especially well under the home rules that replaced European dominance, but the possibility of positive change is at least within their own borders. In the end, the response of most of the world to the white South African apartheid government was critical and supportive of the revolt of the black masses. But that had been a long time coming. The United States government had conducted itself shamefully during the Cold War years, and so also had the Soviet Union up until its own dissolution. Each in its own manner subverted or openly enforced its will upon vast populations throughout the world, and each engaged in the subversion of weaker governments. Each condemned the deplorable regimes in alliance with the other and defended the same ruthlessness of its own allies. As in most civil wars that occurred since World War II, the struggle in South Africa was a miniature Cold War. For a long time rejected by the United States, South Africa's black liberation movement turned to the Soviet Union for weapons and equipment. The United States failed to realize that by siding with oppressive regimes, it pushed the oppressed into the arms of the USSR. When Moscow helped the insurgents, the U.S. ruling status quo tried to destroy the revolt while exaggerating its threats to U.S. interests. This is what occurred in South Africa for almost half a century. And as it was with all such superpower disputes during the Cold War, the escalating trouble in South Africa threatened to be an incipient cause of nuclear war. The way it ended was that the white regime in South Africa disappeared as a final European enclave in the Third World. Sanctions were imposed, trade halted, investments withdrawn, loans canceled, ambassadors recalled, and relations severed. Finally, the white regime was forced to surrender its rule. Apartheid departed history with a whimper rather than a bang. And that was something I wrote. Apartheid means slavery. And actually, I wrote it several years before, but last rewrote it 10 years ago in 2000. And that's the piece I've just read now. And so Mandela had been out of prison a decade at that time. Now it's been 20 years, and perhaps he might be certainly today, the most famous person in the world. And this time, and with this one person, it is well deserved. And along the same note, I'd like to read something, because this is Black History Month, and this again is something I wrote, so my disclaimer holds. It's not just breeding. And a quote from Ralph Ellison from Invisible Man, that blackness is most black, brothers, most black. The story of the United States is struggle between white and black, which was at the core of the Civil War. The three-century genocide against Native Americans is the third leg of the racial triangle. Social programs, even those whose success has resisted the racist demolishment of social spending, are of little help until the nation as a whole resolves the bitter enmity between American blacks and whites. A few years ago, a TV personality gaffed himself in an interview with a reporter from a gay magazine who quoted him as saying, "Most people are born with equal intelligence, but blacks have watered down their genes because the less intelligent ones are the ones that have the most children." He later defended himself. "I said the least fit are proliferating, and I didn't say blacks." The subsequent imbroglio caused by this champion of breeding, only by people of breeding aside, he pointed out an increasing problem about the world population explosion. Humanity is more prolific than rats. As Abraham Lincoln said, God must love poor people because he made so many of them. And by the way, Lincoln's 201st birthday is tomorrow. Most of the world's children are poor and hungry with little chance of education or sustaining employment. It is myopic as well as deceptive to attribute the problem of breeding solely to the people begetting the children. After all, rich or poor, educated or illiterate, black, white, or etc., humanity's single, compelling, and insensate purpose is to breed, to instinctively and virtually, mindlessly perpetuate the species, whether it is a good idea or not. The implication is that intelligent folk are losing genetic headway because they aren't multiplying as rapidly as mentally deficient folk. Yet given that for millions of years, adolescence has been the prime breeding time for human beings, despite modern society's disapproval, perhaps an unwed teenage mother from the inner city has a better chance of producing healthier stock than upscale 30-somethings who establish careers before children. The idea that the least fit are proliferating does not probe the circumstances that might qualify some people less fit to reproduce than others. And if it does indeed target blacks, it is actually on the mark, though for quite opposite reasons than implied. Impoverishment, malnutrition, chronic unemployment, lack of education, or the opportunity for education are major factors toward dissolving the potency of a community, a nation, a race. They are not the result of inferior genes, but of defective social and political policies that might rightfully, though cautiously, be called genocide. Blacks in America have always been a suppressed people. Slaves or free, their arduous, tragic, and unequal role in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Just as the word history seems to imply only male endeavor, his story, so does it also insinuate Western European white male dominance and supremacy over world affairs. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, particularly in the civil rights movement, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of the Enlightenment that gave birth to this nation than any other. This struggle is a continuation of what Washington, Jefferson, Adams, et al. Started, but denied people of color, and that's a quote, who were regarded as property rather than persons born equal, and certainly not born free. The renewed and vengeful backlash of prejudice and oppression against American blacks for having dared challenge white supremacy is revealed as more insidious than mere colonialism or neo-apartheid if it is realized that the underlying intent is for them to indeed breed themselves into helpless oblivion without any means of support for survival and in turn dissolve the will and capacity for them to continue as a people as well as persons. With few exceptions, American blacks are contained and isolated in urban ghettos in much the manner Nazis forced Jews into European ghettos. They are denied adequate education, employment, housing, or health care, forced to subsist on deleterious doles stingily appropriated, which are exploited as examples of the need for abolishing welfare altogether. Their rage is forced inward against themselves. The barely constrained contempt whites hold for blacks is probably equally felt toward whites by blacks, who are victims of the antipathy, but outnumbered 10-1, and without the tremendous legal and firepower of the whites, they are generally unable to strike back against without horrendous consequences. Before Sartre branded the United States war against Vietnam as genocide, he cautioned that the war must be used sparingly and precisely, or it loses its meaning and power, which it has partially because Sartre freed its use. Genocide is defined as the deliberate and systematic destruction of a racial, political, or cultural group. Genocide can be overtly applied through war or by establishing death camps. It can also be carried out more subtly, over a long period, through political and social attrition. The prevailing white attitude toward blacks was summed up by Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Roger Taney, in 1857. When speaking for the majority in Dred Scott, he stated that Negroes were considered, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, unquote. Not all whites are supremacists, though most are racist, if not intentionally, usually on impact. Separate standards are prevalent. It is okay for a white to be armed, but dangerous if a black carries a weapon. The KKK can be, if not forgiven, at least explained. Black power is, however, a threat. The fact that most drug addicts are white is dismissed as a personal flaw of each. Black addiction is thought to be a racial disorder. Whites have fought for and some have died for civil rights for blacks. An unlikely supporter of black liberation was Lyndon Johnson. When he signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, he said, 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived. They came in darkness and in chains. The story of our nation and the American Negro are like two rivers that flow through the centuries along divided channels. When the Liberty Bell rang out in Philadelphia, it did not toll for the Negro. When Andrew Jackson threw open the doors of democracy, they did not open for the Negro. It was only at Appomattox, a century ago, that an American victory was also a Negro victory, and the two rivers, one shining with promise, the other dark-stained with oppression, began to move toward one another. But rivers of blood coursed between them. That same year of 1965, the Watts riot in Los Angeles erupted, and 10 years so after that, actually in 1992, a little longer than that, the worst domestic riot in U.S. history occurred in the same place, because white police who savagely beat a black man senseless were acquitted by an all-white jury. The riot in early May 1992 replaced its predecessor insurrection and those in Detroit and Liberty City, Florida, as the 20th century's worst, all of which flared as a result of treatment by police. White-dominated police forces act in black communities as if they were foreign occupying armies. Most of the time, as Jefferson understood in the Declaration of Independence, people patiently suffer the iron heel, but an excessive act, such as the acquittal of cops for beating Rodney King, can be the final indignity that erupts in thermonuclear reaction. Racism will only end when children of every race are taught early that the color of skin is a far less concern than the quality of hearts and minds. That will not be easy. No less than the essential education system of the USA must be uprooted and rewired to reflect the common struggle of both races to build and survive in this country. Then perhaps Lyndon Johnson's two rivers might converge. One of Voltaire's friends said there would be never justice, equality, or freedom in the world until the last king was strangled with the intestines of the last priest. He might have included dispatching racial supremacists, not only because they cause much of the world's troubles, they also substantiate the general theory of genetic defectibility. Skinheads, as a friend of mine says, have more hair than brains. And that was something I wrote. It's just breeding. And to finish the program, I'd like to give a nod to Valentine's Day, which is this coming Sunday. But it's also the 151st anniversary of Oregon. It's Oregon's birthday. And a friend of mine is going to hold a 151 party with the rum, of course. A Second Chance with Shirley. I wrote this thing back in 1981, so bear with me. It is a little archaic. I live alone in a cluttered shanty on the Oregon coast just above the ocean. I have lived in this place more than 2 years and in other lonely hovels on the coast for 5 years before that. I am drawn to the ocean. I have worked on albacore tuna boats and to being alone. I am alone most of the time. I read and walk on the beach. Sometimes I pretend that I am the only human on earth, an illusion that is not difficult to nourish during the stormy, dreary winters. Often when I walk on the beach, I hear voices, whispers from the trees that hold up the cliffs, and perhaps from across time. I think of them as primeval voices of ancestors protesting their rupture from the forests, the memories of each human being of a wilder life that civilization has never completely erased. One morning in late winter, I find a large glass fishing float among the dying pudding of millions of jellyfish. Sailors of the sea, they are called, driven onto the beach by west winds. That same day, I receive word that a friend is sick and requires 24-hour care in a Portland hospital. I telephone his house from a cafe near my shack. The voice on the other end is not my friend's wife. "Shirley," she says. After I hang up, I realize who she is. 6 years ago, we were casual lovers. She lived in the same house as my friend and his wife, and we made love the first time in her upstairs bedroom. She visited me at the coast a few times that winter, generally with my friend and his wife. In the spring, she met a man from Alaska and went to live with him near Fairbanks. She married him 2 years later. I don't believe I thought of her during those 6 years, except for a few times when my friend's wife mentioned her. I catch a ride into Portland. I have worked in hospitals, generally ER and bedpan patrol, and plan to stand shifts at my friend's bedside. I ride in the canopied back of a pickup truck through the coastal mountains. I look out the back of the truck at the ocean. It is a blue mass that rises above trees and receding ridges as we climb into the pass. White specks of fishing boats cluster on a spot of water like a flutter of birds. Tall columns of rain clouds move toward shore. We outrace them inland, and the ocean abruptly disappears at a sharp turn around a forested ridge. Two young brothers ride in the back with me and pass the time trying to scare me with horror stories, and they shout insults at passing cars. Near the summit, we see smoke slipping through the volcanic, blasted peak of Mount St. Helens, once a perfect ice cream cone. We reach the city and cross the river to its southeast side. It is late afternoon when we reach my friend's house. Mount Hood shines like a knife blade and dominates the horizon of a field next to his house. Everyone in the truck goes into the house and uses the bathroom. Shirley stands at the front door somewhat perplexed. She smiles when I tell her it has been a long ride. A small boy stands next to her. I vaguely recall that my friend's wife told me Shirley had a son. He looks straight into my eyes and clutches her leg. The bathroom empties. The invaders load into the truck and drive off. The brothers shout insults at me from the back. I am alone with Shirley and the boy. She tells me she is divorcing her husband. She is not certain that she and the boy will return to Alaska. Her son is at the terrible twos, she says. She smiles. He regards me seriously. I instantly love them both. The sudden feeling for her and the boy is unexpected. I stare at her in surprise. She is thinner. 6 years have sharply defined her face. Her eyes are steady. Her chin is slightly cleft. Her brown hair hangs straight down her head. She is pretty. I have new respect for the word. We spend several days together. We drive my friend's wife to the hospital. We visit with him and help move his body around. He is recovering from surgery that released a compressed spinal cord in his neck. Movement is slowly returning into his deadened limbs. He says he feels like hot lava is flowing through his central nervous system. I give him the glass float I found on the beach. His wife stays with him all day and into each night. Shirley and the boy and I spend the days touring the city in my friend's car. We are rubes. She has spent the past 6 years farming and trapping and cleaning small town streets. My life has not been so useful. I subsist at no regular employment. Neither of us has been in the city for quite some time. We shop at stores. We mix into crowds simply for the pleasure of being among so many people. We sit in a park across the street from my friend's house. We sit around the house and talk. She touches me at times. She stands close to me. She sits next to me on the couch. She approves that her son and I become quick friends. He is a delightful boy, a happy boy. Ordering a hot dog for her son and coffee for us at a downtown cafeteria, I look back at our table. They stare at me. He laughs and waves his hands. She smiles. A sweetness fills her face. The first night she falls asleep on the couch in my friend's house. I wake her up. She leans forward. She cradles her head in her hands and presses against her knees. She sits up and thrusts her face at me. She kisses me goodnight and walks into a bedroom she shares with her son, who is asleep. She kisses me again the second night. We lay on the floor at angles to each other in front of a fire and a fireplace. We doze, our heads sharing a pillow. We awaken the same instant. She rolls into my arms and kisses me several times. She gets up and joins her son in bed. She gets drunk the third night. Her face crumples into a crying jag. She cries about the breakup with her husband and about another man she took as a lover. Her enraged husband threatened to kill her and the boy. Later, he begs forgiveness. She refuses and brings the boy to Portland. My friend's wife talks with Shirley, whose crying jags multiply. The boy's father is a good man and deserves a fair share in his son's life, she says. Shirley breaks down. She admits to being selfish and afraid and, in tears, acknowledges that she must share her son, who sleeps through it all in the bedroom. At first, I am put off by Shirley. Her face is puffy and watery, her eyes red and unforgiving, her words coarse and loud. Then I realize her implacable drunkenness is a catharsis, a raw, painful expression of what she wants to do, not what she knows she must. Much later, Shirley sits against my legs while I lie near the fireplace. She says that men have been unfair with her, that they have used her. She pats my leg. "Except you," she says. Her smile is streaked with tears. She seems to forget I used her 6 years ago. She has a hangover the next morning. I hear her son crying and look into the bedroom. She holds him. I lie on the bed and wrap my arms around her body, which is warm from sleep. She takes my fingers and traces them along her cesarean scar. She places my hand on her breasts. She turns to face me and kisses me. She turns again and gently unfolds her son's face in her hands. It is red and opens like a swollen flower. He squirms his head onto her shoulder. He looks at me. I reach a hand toward him. He grasps my fingers and tightens his small hand around them. She receives a phone call from Alaska that morning. It is from a man. She closes the kitchen door and talks for a long time. She says nothing about the call, but a distance develops between us. It is not apparent to me at first. And when it is, I am confused. She disengages from me in the same delicate manner we drew close. I talk with her. She is vague. I kiss her. She does not return the kiss. She does not touch me or stand close. She gently slips out of my embrace. She sits on the far side of the couch or in a chair. I silently release my grasp. Her son and I grow closer, perhaps in consequence, but not as maneuver. She does not discourage it. It still seems to please her. At least she does not find fault with me entirely. I am unsure what turned her off. I don't know if it's something within me that needs filling or wrenched out. I stand shifts at my friend's bedside. I move him around the bed whenever he is in pain or discomfort. I wash him. I feed him. I put him on a bedpan and hold a urinal for him. I walk up and down in his room or in the corridors outside when he sleeps. I ask 1,000 times over what happened. Why had she and I fallen apart so quickly? I start to resent her. When I speak to her, it is with an underlying harshness. We are barely speaking to each other on the final day. She is going to Alaska. I paint and work around my friend's house most of the morning on that final day. In the afternoon, I go for a walk. I start out across the park and walk several miles along busy streets. My brittle feelings calm. I buy a box of animal crackers for the boy. I show it to Shirley at the house. She stands over her sleeping son in the bedroom. "For the plane," I whisper, and hold up the box. She smiles. That evening, we arrive at the airport an hour early. Shirley belts a few stiff drinks for the ride north. I hold her son while he stands on a railing in front of a large dark window. He presses his cheek to mine and puts his hands over my hands. We watch jet airplanes take off and land. It is past dusk. The sky is swept with scattered rain clouds. The lights of planes scrape their bottoms. It is a special moment while I hold the boy. I talk to him softly and point out the aluminum fireflies. I see Shirley's face mirrored in the glass. She sits with my friend's wife. The airliner she and her son will ride into Alaska rolls up from Montana. The boy is transfixed by the medley of offloading passengers who leave the plane through a chute and walk up a ramp inside the building. We see the suitcase Shirley borrowed from my friend's wife loaded on a conveyor belt and into the plane. It is time. Shirley says goodbye to my friend's wife. She turns to me and says goodbye. She suddenly reaches an arm around my neck and kisses me hard on the mouth. I grasp her for a moment. I think it is understood between us. The small, sad comedy unites us the instant it separates us. She takes her son down the loading ramp. She shouts a final goodbye. My friend's wife returns it with a bellow. I say nothing. I begin to erase her from my mind. And that was a second time with Shirley. And this has been Michael McCusker.